Well, my thanks, my profound thanks to Cole Durham and his colleagues here at the center. I am a great admirer of Cole and what he does around the world, and it's quite humbling for me to face this audience of people from around the world. And I just am deeply grateful and delighted to be here. The title of my talk, as you can see, is Organizational Religious Pluralism, Anchoring Thriving Societies. And the following is my theme, that there's a paradox of government and civil society. And this is the paradox. The impulse of governments around the world is to control organizational religious pluralism, either by restricting all religion, restricting particular religions, by fusing state and religion, or by enforcing religious orthodoxy. But this actually undermines the very flourishing civil society that produces, we have good evidence, social cohesion, citizen loyalty, and growing economies, the very things governments want to promote. So in the interest of the governments, of the states, we actually have to restrain the hegemonic impulse that governments have, and that's going to be my theme, that there is a kind of impulse of government to intrude upon civil society, and actually it undermines their own efficacy. So why is control by the state or by governments counterproductive? First of all, because religion draws upon the deepest human yearnings for identity and meaning and purpose and ultimate destiny. It's who we are at a deep level. And when that sense of identity and conscience and purpose is prevented by the state, people perceive it as a violation of their fundamental dignity. We also can't anymore ignore the importance of religion because it's a powerful force around the globe today. And I would recommend the new book, God's Century, by Toff, Philpott, and Shaw, which attempts to survey kind of this new force in global politics. And their argument is that repression tends to produce the very militancy that governments are trying to deal with. Once again, this paradox. Another reason why the attempt to control religious civil society organizations will fail is that pluralism is the natural condition of religion. I would say that's the nature of human beings, to have different ideas, practices, cultures with respect to the divine. But it's particularly true in our globalizing age. And the great sociologist Peter Berger argues that in the global environment, everyone is everywhere. Saudi Arabia may deny religious diversity in its midst and try to enforce religious uniformity, but in fact, there's diversity in Saudi Arabia and everywhere else in the world. And so the irony is that national unity is more likely to be achieved by an acceptance of religious diversity rather than an attempt to enforce some kind of uniformity, whether secular or religious. So I want to talk primarily this afternoon from the perspective of a social scientist. I'm a political scientist, I'm not a lawyer, but I read a lot of sociology, so I draw upon sociology and political science to a certain extent, law and other fields. What I want to do is summarize evidence from the social sciences about the link between religious organizations, civil society, and human flourishing. Tocqueville in America first noticed the vibrant role of religious communities and institutions in the new American regime. In fact, Alexis de Tocqueville famously said, "Religion is the first of the American political institutions." And he said, but that's not because religion is involved in politics per se. It's because it provides the cultural mores, the joining, the association, the socialization that makes democratic citizenship possible. And there's been a renewed interest in the importance of how people thrive in the mediating institutions, that those institutions shouldn't be displaced by the state. And in a sense, this goes to the ontology of human life. Who are we? If we are only isolated individuals confronting a powerful state, or isolated individuals dealing in the marketplace. There's something human that's lost. And we human beings thrive in that mediating set of institutions, of churches and associations and neighborhoods and so forth. And to the extent that the state displaces that, it undermines human flourishing, I would argue. Next, there's an extensive literature now on how religious associations produce social capital. And social capital goes back in sociology and political science some decades, but it was popularized by the scholar Robert Putnam. Social capital being the norms and networks of reciprocity and trust that enable people to do common things together. And he argued that half of all social capital in the United States is produced in religious organizations, churches and other charities and associations. Finally, there's a whole series of scholarship and political science about how participation in mediating institutions, and especially in religious institutions in American life, teach civic skills and democratic deliberation. So we learn how to run meetings and do leadership and raise money and deliberate with each other and listen and speak in public and so forth. And some scholars even argue that in America, churches and religious organizations and associations provide a unique way for people to learn these civic skills, people who are not so elite in American society. Now, moving on from my sort of overview of the social sciences, I would like to recommend to you a very important, I think, seminal article by Alfred Stepan, who's a political scientist at Columbia University. He's a comparative politics scholar. He's a scholar of democracy. And he has an article called Religion, Democracy, and the Twin Tolerations. And he asks the simple question, what are the institutional requirements of stable democracies and healthy societies? What are they? And he comes to the conclusion that central to stable democracies is a relation between religious institutions and organizations and the state. And this is what the twin tolerations is. The state allows, protects, and thus tolerates religious organizations to operate in civil society, even politics. In other words, religious organizations can petition their government, they can organize, and so forth. And in return, religious institutions agree to tolerate others in civil society and to renounce the use of coercive state power to repress their competitors. So there are twin, in a sense, temptations and twin tolerations. The state is tempted, in a sense, to repress civil society, religious civil society, and religious institutions, especially dominant ones, are tempted to use the coercive power of the state to repress their competitors, to get special privileges in law and constitutional provisions. And Stepan argues that, in fact, that is a good democratic bargain, that religion gives up special prerogatives, but in return gets the freedom to operate in civil society. And in fact, he argues this is the foundation for democratic, stable societies, especially in a fervently religious world. Now, this is an important point. Stepan argues that the twin tolerations does not require a secular state, does not require a state that's hostile to religion, does not require the separation of church and state. There can be a variety of church-state kind of regimes in which the twin tolerations operates, he argues. We can go into that more. So what's the record? Well, unfortunately, the twin tolerations is violated around the world in the sense that governments are repressing religious communities, institutions, associations. And we have this from studies that you have probably heard about, but I'll review here briefly. The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life has conducted a very sophisticated set of studies measuring the degree of restrictions on religion around the world. And they just released a report this fall in which they found a year ago it was 70%. Now it's 75% of the world's population live in countries where religion is restricted at a high or very high level according to their measurement coding. And believers face discrimination, intimidation, harassment, arrest, torture, and death. Communities and organizations face onerous registration rules, obstacles to formation of ministries, schools, property destruction, mob violence, and so forth. And what we know, what I think we know, is that this is retarding democratic progress and freedom around the world. A study by Freedom House recently showed that freedom was beginning to advance, was advancing in a general way up until around 2005. So there were more countries moving into what they call the free category or the partly free. And then in 2005, it leveled off, and then it's been declining since. And I would submit that that's in part because of this vast violation of the twin tolerations by governments around the world, violating religious practice, infringing upon religious freedom. Now, this is a slightly older table, but it shows what I was talking about here with respect to the Pew Forum. A minority, this is perhaps a good story, good news and bad news story. And the good news is that actually only a minority of countries have high or very high restrictions on religion, according to the Pew Forum study. As you can see, if I can use this here, the high or very high is 32% of the countries. Unfortunately, those countries comprise 70% and now 75% of the world's population. China and India is another one. China because of government restrictions, India because of social hostilities, mob violence, and so forth. But this is not only a story about what's going on, quote, around the world. I would submit that the hegemonic impulse of the state, of government, is a kind of a universal tendency. And we're seeing that now in the United States. So this is what I call threats in the cradle of liberty, or the cradle of the United States, the home of the First Amendment, a free exercise of religion constitutionally mandated. And there are many more of these. I have a long list of these that I categorized. But I want to highlight a few of these. Because I think they illustrate this issue of the need to protect religious civil society from the intrusions of the state. In 2006, an historic century-old Catholic Charities adoption program in Massachusetts was faced with a choice. Either place children in violation of its religious conscience, place children in same-sex couples for adoption, or lose its license by the state of Massachusetts. And the church remonstrated with the state. They asked for an exemption. They didn't ask. They said they would refer other people to gay couples if they could. And in fact, this Catholic Charities operation specialized in the placement of hard-to-adopt children. In fact, all the adoption professionals in the state said, please preserve this niche. It provides placement for handicapped, older children, minority children. But the state did not back down. And this was a state at the time that Governor Romney was governor of, which is something about this impulse. And so Catholic Charities, faced with this choice, shut down its adoption program, 100-year-old adoption program. And I'll just mention the 2010, because this follows on the same impulse. In 2010, the District of Columbia Catholic Charity shut down its foster care and adoption program. 2011, Illinois diocesan foster care programs were shut down. So there has been a wave of these, which, as we'll see, leads to some other significant issues. But there's also an issue of zoning. And as we're seeing, increasingly, churches, mosques, synagogues, temples are facing challenges to getting permission to build or expand their houses of worship. So nettlesome local zoning officials want to prevent this. And in the city of Leon Valley, Texas, they really wanted to just maximize tax revenue. They wanted to maximize tax revenue, so they zoned out all churches in the whole business corridor of the city. Ultimately, the Beckett Fund, which is represented here by Tina Ramirez, was able to get that struck down. But the point here is that there's a number of these. So you can see the New York City is, religious clubs have been shut out of universities. New York City has banned church rental of school buildings. There are multiple lawsuits, as you know, against the Health and Human Services contraceptive mandate. And it goes on. And so the point here is that the logic of this global trend to control religious civil society organizations continues not just around the world, but in the United States. And significantly, in the most recent Pew Forum study, the score or the measurement of restrictions on religion for the United States went up a full point. That's a hugely significant development. So the United States now gets, it's no longer in the low category in restrictions. It's now in the moderate category, and it's going higher. Now, what I want to present is some groundbreaking empirical research that I would recommend to you that I think helps to bring together why we should care about this, both at home and around the world. There is an historic documentary record that we have now through the International Religious Freedom Act, State Department reports, UN reports, NGO reports. We actually have a global database now of conditions around the world. This has enabled the Pew Forum to do its coding and its measurement of restrictions on religion. But it's also enabled sophisticated research methods to actually then correlate those restrictions with other aspects of social benefits or harms. And so I would recommend to you the book by Brian Grimm and Roger Finke, The Price of Freedom Denied, Religious Persecution in the 21st Century. What Grimm and Finke do is very sophisticated quantitative analysis that correlates restrictions on religion with other social outcomes, democracy, human rights, civil liberties, women's rights, economic flourishing, stability, peace, harmony, and so forth. And what they find is that restrictions on religion produce grievances, strife, militancy, and violence. Organizational freedom produces positive social outcomes. And I argue, in a sense, it's a liminal book because for centuries, scholars and thinkers have been making a case for why religious freedom mattered. Now they have powerful empirical evidence that, in fact, it does. And it goes to the heart of the crucible of the 21st century. Now, I just want to share this table. This is statistical correlations of the correlation of religious freedom with other freedoms. This is from Brian Grimm and Roger Finke's book. And notice these are very powerful. The ones on the right, the left side, are very powerful correlations. Political freedom, freedom of the press, civil liberties, gender empowerment. Societies that restrict religious freedom tend to have a much lower status of women, and societies that protect religious freedom tend to, in fact, empower women. Lower GDP spent on military, longevity of democracy. You can follow around. These are all correlations with religious freedom and other freedoms. But as often is said, correlation is not causation. So Grimm and Finke go the next step, and they develop a theory, and they deduce hypotheses from that theory, and then they test them with the most rigorous quantitative methods available. And they develop this model. Now, these linkages are actually all based upon a statistical method called structural equation modeling, which I don't fully understand, but I know it's rigorous. And it's very well substantiated, corroborated. And notice the religious violence cycle that they show through their analysis, that governmental restrictions on religion lead to more violence and grievances on religion, which lead to more social hostilities and social restrictions on religion, which feeds then into government. So you get a kind of cycle. The government feels like it has to control religion. It controls it. It creates grievances. That creates more strife in society. More strife in society leads the government to feel like it's got to clamp down more on religion. And you get a religious violence cycle. They argue there's a religious freedom cycle, that when governments relax their restrictions on religious civil society, on religious organizations, and allow them some autonomy, that those organizations then contribute in a positive way to society. They have a stake in society. They have a stake in the regime. And so it leads to broader participation, positive contributions of religion to society, and therefore the ability to relax further the restrictions on religion. And I like this comparison because it suggests that this cycle can operate in the same place with the same religious community based upon different diverging paths. So the state of Qatar in the Gulf actually embarked through the Emir on a path of relaxing restrictions on religion, allowing Christian churches to be built for the first time in the Gulf in centuries. And that led to less interreligious strife, more participation by religious communities, far less social hostilities of religion, and a kind of flourishing of Qatar society. And notice what Saudi Arabia is like, that religious violence cycle. The repression of religious minorities creates grievances and hostilities, empowers the bullies, and that's what we're going to get. So how can governments promote this positive cycle? Certain steps. They can protect the autonomy of peaceful religious organizations. They can provide legal personality, the right to form associations, own property, appoint leaders, operate schools, run charitable ministries. They can allow religious organizations the right to print literature, petition government, voice public concerns. And they must renounce anti-cult, anti-conversion, blasphemy, and apostasy laws, because these are the very things which invite social hostilities and mob violence against those who are unfavored or are accused of blasphemy, apostasy, or conversionary activity. But then the question often that's asked by governments is, well, then how can we protect our people from harmful religion if you're asking us to do all these things? Well, there's education. There is the salvific effect of the societal participation and healthy competition. And the government still has the ability to use existing law against incitement to violence, slander and libel, fraud and abuse, public health. Governments are well armed to deal with those situations in which religious groups may be moving beyond peaceful competition. They can deal with those. Now, I want to offer, kind of in summary, I've been summarizing briefly, very briefly, the social science evidence for the positive cycles that can occur when religious civil society organizations are allowed to operate and peacefully compete. So I'm a social scientist, but I want to present at the end here a kind of theological overview. Because what's fascinating to me is that various religious communities have developed ideas about the importance of this mediating level of institutional life in society. So we have the Catholic doctrine of subsidiarity, the idea that decisions should be made at the lowest level possible, first by families, then neighborhoods, then unions and associations and churches, and then cities, and then counties, and then the national government. All have their place, but the higher level shouldn't supplant the lower subsidiary levels. The Protestant reform, the Reformed Protestant idea of sphere sovereignty echoes this. The idea that different spheres in society have different roles to play, and that for the state to encroach on the sphere of the family or the church or the religious association is in fact going to undermine society. I have learned at this conference that LDS Doctrine and Covenants on Government actually has a kind of idea about the twin tolerations and how the religious community should not have special privileges by the state that enables it to harass or repress competitors, and the state in turn must protect the autonomy of these religious associations. But I'd like to mention the Muslim understanding of God's will is evoked in Surah 548, which I have embraced as a beautiful illustration of this notion. And the full passage says, had God or Allah willed, he could have created you one people. Had God willed, he could have created you one people. But he made you many so that you would have to be tested. And how are you to show that you are faithful? You are to vie one with another in virtue, which to me captures the idea of peaceful competition among people. Let's vie to see who runs the best ministries and charities and embraces people with the greatest love. Let's have that kind of competition. And if we do, then we can have a picture, which I like to I'll end with here. It's an image of the religious harmony that can come by this civil society diversity of organizations. And some years ago, I was doing a study for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life on religious lobbying and advocacy. And I was interviewing a young Sikh man with his turban who was describing how in America, he said, you know, here you can be who you are, because in France, I couldn't get a driver's license probably because I'd have to take off my turban and violate my religion. But he said, there's this law in Oregon that was passed by the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s that denies the right of teachers to wear religious garb. It was aimed at Catholic nuns and priests. But now it prevents an Orthodox Jew and a Sikh and a Muslim woman of cover from teaching in the Oregon public schools. And this was in 2009, and he said, I'm going to go after that law. And I said, sure, some young Sikh lobbyist is going to go after this law. But he found willing allies among Baptists and Catholics and Jews and Muslims, and this is the result. A portrait of religious organizations in harmony, the signing ceremony ending Oregon's 1923 KK-backed law against religious attire in public schools, April 1st, 2010, which to me has become almost an iconic photograph of the new religious America and of the idea that religious harmony can come from diversity and from the acceptance of that diversity in American life. Thank you.